This week in Retronauts, go east, young man. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Retronauts episode, I want to say 87. Or if you want to call it Retronauts East Episode 1, you can do that. I'm Jeremy Parrish, and this is the first episode of Retronauts East, which is the new little splinter faction of the splinter cell of Retronauts. As part of our Patreon funding, we set a goal that said, if we can get to a certain point, then we will go weekly and we will add some new show concepts to the show, to the schedule. And one of them was a recording set in where I live, as opposed to me having to fly to San Francisco to record, which gets kind of expensive, and I can't do that like every week. So instead, we're recording here in Raleigh, North Carolina, and I have some native video game experts on hand. So why don't you guys introduce yourselves?
Hi, I'm Benj Edwards. I'm a freelance journalist. And I've known Jeremy for a long time. We used to work together.
Yeah, you contributed to 1UP back when I was there, laboring under the banner of Ziff Davis.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you are now?
I am still a journalist. I write for Fast Company, PC World, PC Mag, The Atlantic sometimes. I focus on history of games and computers.
And you have a personal site too, don't you?
Yeah, vintagecomputing.com.
Yeah.
It's a blog I've run since 2005.
You used to do like what, the scan of the week?
But yeah, retro scan of the week. Yeah. For 10 years, every Monday.
I guess in the age of Tumblr, there's not really much space for that.
Yeah. Yeah. Probably became obsolete about 5 years ago.
But you still post there quite a bit.
Yeah, I do. It's kicking up a notch now because I did the Patreon thing too.
Right. Yeah. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, sure.
You can promote yourself here. Why not?
Patreon.com/Benj Edwards. It's going to fund deep looks into video game and computer history. I'm going to try to uncover things no one's ever written about before. And then after that, I'll talk about them on Retronauts.
Nice. Can you give us any hints about what you're writing about, or do you want to maintain your specialness?
Let's see. I don't know.
I totally understand like guarding that sort of thing, because as soon as you say, oh yeah, I want to write about this, then someone else
everybody
says,
jumps on
I should go do that first.
The thing is also, it gives people ideas and they don't even realize they get the ideas because they just read it or hear it somewhere and they're like, oh, I should do this or that. But
all right, you can keep it clandestine for now.
Okay.
That's fine. So we can all look forward to that. When do you think your first article from that will hit?
Right now, I am editing an interview with Ed Smith that I did last year, and he was the creator of the APF MP1000 console, which was a really obscure 1970s cartridge-based console. And
I don't know if I've heard of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was very notable because he's one of the few African American video game pioneers in the industry. One of like two or three that I know of from that era.
Right. And unfortunately, Jerry Lawson passed away a few years ago, so you can't really talk to him anymore. So basically everything that's known about him is out there, kind of like, you know, Satoru Iwata.
Everything is based on my interview I did with him in 2009.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like everything. So.
And then, Ben, what about yourself?
Hey, so my name is Ben Elgin. I'm not any kind of vintage expert like Benj here. My main qualification is that I'm as old as Jeremy, so I grew up with this stuff. I am a programmer, though. I've been doing programming with a focus on computer graphics for a long time. Went to grad school for that, so I may have some of that angle to contribute. And I hadn't worked with a lot of these old systems as I was growing up, so hopefully we'll be able to tell you something interesting about them.
Yeah, and I think the first interaction I remember having with you was after I wrote I know I've seen your name around online before this, but back when I wrote a retrospective on Adventure for Atari 2600, and apparently you worked with Warren Robinette and showed it to him, and were like, so what do you think about this?
Right, yeah, so this is basically a complete coincidence, but I shared an office with Warren Robinette, who was at Atari and who was basically the sole programmer behind Adventure. just because we were doing a little startup company and we had extra office space and we rented it to him, was basically how that happened. So he was working on some other educational software products, I think maybe with Broaderbund, but I'm not sure, at that time. So yeah, and he really appreciated the interest in his older work. That was the one where he had the, Easter egg of his name. If you could pick up a specific pixel with your little avatar and bring it to the right room, which was one of the first Easter eggs ever. So that was a lot of fun. But yeah, and I've been following your stuff, Jeremy, since, I don't know, GeoCities.
That's a long time ago.
I remember a Strider Splash page. That was
back in the days of Splash Toasty pages. Frog. Before you had to just jump right in to the websites. Yep.
I think that qualifies you to be here sharing with Warren Robinette.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Didn't he do Rocky's Boots, that educational game that was
that
highly
sounds
acclaimed?
Right. Yeah, he worked through a series of different educational games.
This is, as I said, the debut episode of Retronauts East, which we're just numbering, you know, like a normal Retronauts episode. So you'll have to please forgive any awkwardness or weirdness with this episode. We're still figuring out the recording situation. I don't have all the cables that I quite need in place.
We're all in shock at what we look like in person for the first time.
That and we're trying out a recording space that may not be the right recording space. It's actually open.
Like a cavern.
What's that?
Cavern.
It's yeah.
Cavern.
So, you know, when we do the Colossal Cave Adventure episode, that'll be perfect. But but for the moment, the audio on this may be below par. So if that's the case, then we'll retool things for next time. So bear with us. But hopefully the conversation will be good enough that you won't mind.
Well, we may hit Colossal Cave in this one at some point.
Adventure is on here,
yeah,
but Colossal Cave, Cave isn't.
Well,
is it?
No, it predates. But Advent came out of that same
it
work.
It did. But we don't want to get too bogged down with details.
Yeah.
So yeah, with that, why don't we move into this week's topic? So to kick off the first episode of Retronauts East, what I'd really like to do with this group and, you know, other people that I might bring in for recording, depending on, you know, expertise and everything, is touch on topics that we don't really normally get to in the course of regular Retronauts, because Bob and I tend to share pretty much the same interests. There's some stuff he likes that I don't and vice versa, but it all tends to be kind of, you know, 8-bit, 16-bit Japanese console games, things like microcomputers and even American consoles we're pretty weak on. And people complain that we don't cover those topics. But then when we do cover the topics out of a sense of obligation, people also complain because we're not really experts on those. So we can't speak to them with, you know, the wisdom of experience. So my hope is that, you know, with Retronauts East, we can delve into other topics, you know. I know Benj definitely has a lot of expertise on vintage 8-bit computers and things like that that I am just completely weak on. So we're kind of putting everything on your shoulders, I guess.
Yeah, early American video games is my specialty.
Right. So you can look forward to that. And with this one, we're going back to kind of, not the original video game system, but the original American computer in a lot of ways, the Apple II. Of course, Apple II wasn't the first American computer, but it was really, in a lot of ways, the breakout computer, the point at which the idea of computers as a consumer commodity, as an appliance, as something everyone could own and use and play on and also work on, really took off. And we were going to talk about a different computer to start out with, but as I thought about it, I realized that in order to really talk about any other computers of that era, the late 70s, early 80s, I really think you have to lay down the basic here and start with Apple II, because it was so important and so influential on everything that came after. And it had an amazingly long life. It was it debuted in 1977, and Apple supported it until 1993. by which point it was obviously incredibly obsolete, but it just had that much traction. It's like, you know, Game Boy or something, where there's just so many people that own it that they keep making games for it. We talked about the Nintendo Wii recently, and even though that's now about to go into its second successor, there were still Wii games coming out last year, 2016. So, you know, when a system has a huge install base, especially with, you know, a very sort of casual market that doesn't feel the need to upgrade immediately and go to the next best thing, they tend to have a really long life and be supported for a long, long time. So that's definitely the case with Apple II.
I think also an institutional market is part of that, just because the Apple II ended up in a lot of the computing labs and grade school labs and that sort of thing. And they're not going to be upgrading to the next great thing every year.
That is true.
I think that that gave it the last 10 years of its life.
Yeah.
From 83 to 93. The huge install base in schools around America. Steve Jobs made a huge push to court the educational market very early on. And he got, you know, huge computer labs full of them around the country and around the world. So
Yeah. I mean, that was a very smart strategy on his part. And, you know, the Apple II was relatively expensive compared to some other computers that came out a few years later, like the Commodore 64. Mm-hmm. But at the time, you know, it sold for like $1,200 at the base level, which is a lot in modern day money. But for a computer at that time, that was incredibly reasonable. I mean, you know, this was an era where a lot of people, if they wanted to do computing, would have to go to a university and use share time on a VAX or a mainframe or something. And to have your own computer in your own house or in your own classroom that was, you know, standalone device, you didn't have to share it, you didn't have to, you know, worry about computing time or anything like that. That was a pretty big revolution. So yeah, that made a big, big difference.
Yeah, at the time, there were some sort of all-in-one computers that predated the Apple II from IBM and Wang and some other, but they all cost like $10,000 to $15,000.
Right.
So, and that was like $50,000 in inflation. Mm-hmm. I just did the numbers on a word processor that was sold for $15,078, and it's like $53,000 or something.
Yeah.
It was all in one. Man, it's crazy. So yeah, $1,200 is a good deal for that.
Very good deal. Yeah.
Yeah. The bigger ones, households weren't going to have them, and schools weren't going to be able to afford those either.
Yeah.
Unless you were some amazing private school.
So to understand how the Apple II came into being, we have to talk a little bit about Apple itself and what came before the Apple II, because obviously it's the Apple II. There was something before that. So of course, Apple Computer, you've probably heard of them. They started out as kind of a GarageBand video game, or not video game, but computing company working out of a garage. Like, you know, to fund their first product, Steve Jobs, one of the three co-founders, sold his van. I think Steve Wozniak, one of the other co-founders, sold his HP calculator. Uh-huh. So it was one of those things where it was just like some really young dudes who had a great idea and decided to pursue it, and, you know, had that sort of freedom and bohemian nonchalance, I guess, to be able to actually make some sacrifices to pursue it. And clearly it worked out for them. There was one other founder, Ronald Wayne. In the notes, I wrote down that he was the Stu Sutcliffe of Apple. He quit before they became really big, kind of like Beatles bassist Stu Sutcliffe. Yeah, it's getting kind of retro there. But anyway, Wozniak and Jobs were really the two sort of movers and shakers. Steve Jobs was the business guy. Like, he was kind of like a Nolan Bushnell. Like, he understood business and understood people and was a good salesman and had a lot of ideas and not so good at actually making things happen on the technical side. But Steve Wozniak was, I would say it's fair to class him as a bit of a genius. Just a guy who really he intuited electronics. He would, you know, look at computers or a schematic and think, I can make this better. I don't know if you guys want to talk about the breakout story. That's kind of the famous.
He dreamed in circuitry, I guess. The Apple sort of originated out of Atari and Nolan Bushnell's management style, which was very egalitarian and allowed a lot of room for feedback from every level of employee in the place. And so Atari, Steve Jobs worked for Atari in 74 or so, and they hired him to be an engineering assistant or something like that. And they wanted him to design a new video game called Breakout. That was Nolan Bushnell's idea. And so they assigned him the project. And of course, Steve Jobs went to his buddy Woz, who actually knew how to design stuff, and said, could you do this for me? And there's a whole big story about all that and whether he gypped Woz of money. And
right. Supposedly like they offered an incentive, like the simpler you can make this, this board,
you get a bonus for every,
money we'll give you. Every integrated chip you don't take out. Yeah.
Put in or something like that. Yeah.
And yeah, Wozniak made it so simple and elegant that they couldn't figure out how to reproduce it. So they actually, the final product was more complex. But
that's what, Alan Alcorn, the first time I ever talked to him, I asked him about that. I said, did you use Woz's design? He said, no. But Woz still thinks it was his design in the production arcade game. But one thing a lot of people don't know is that Ronald Wayne also worked for Atari.
Okay.
And Al Alcorn told me that recently, too, when I was talking to him. So a lot of the culture, the company culture of Atari, I mean, Apple, came out of Atari. And so
out of early Atari, which was different than Warner Atari.
Yeah, before Warner came in.
So the sort of bohemian.
Yeah.
Although it did have its limits. I've read that Steve Jobs was pretty unpopular at Atari because he was like the super hippie guy who didn't bathe.
Yeah.
It's hard to reconcile that with, you know, the dude in the Japanese custom design black turtlenecks, but
he was just so young. I mean, everybody's got to have a chance to grow up, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, he definitely was that kind of like hippie sort of guy at the time, but he certainly matured out of that. So anyway, Jobs and Wozniak had their dream of creating a computer, and the idea was a kit computer, which was a pretty common thing back then. It was basically like, here's the components, you finish it yourself. So they called it the Apple One, and it retailed for $666.66, which was apparently not a sassy reference to Satanism, but in fact was just because Steve Wozniak was like, it's numbers. I like numbers that repeat. So that's why they
two-thirds of a grand.
The Apple One originated when Woz wanted to design his own little terminal to dial into a mainframe through a modem and program on that mainframe. And so he just wanted a cheap TV terminal that he could hook up to a TV set as a display. And so it was one of the first, if not the first, computers that hooked up to a TV set. Mm-hmm. And that was a groundbreaking thing.
Yeah, that was really revolutionary because before that you had like oscilloscopes or, you know, really big monitors.
Terminals mostly. Yeah. It's like separate serial terminals that were like a computer unto themselves. They'd connect through a serial connection. That was really popular.
Yeah. Or if you wanted to do real graphics, you had a whole huge separate device for that. I mean,
you could have a graphical terminal.
Yeah. When I was in grad school at UNC, there was the team there that worked on the pixel planes, which was an entire cabinet full of boards just to address, you know, a large number of pixels with colors. And it's, you know, it's this whole huge refrigerator sized device into itself just to do that.
Yeah. But,
yeah, so the real revolution of the Apple One was, like Ben said, the the ability for it to use basically consumer televisions to output video.
Composite video output. In fact, when I did a slideshow about the history of computer displays, I talked to Woz and Lee Felsenstein, who designed a similar computer at the same time that used a composite display. And I was trying to figure out who was first. And actually, I don't exactly remember. You'd have to read that on PC World to find out.
In a lot of cases, things like that, it doesn't really matter who is first because they took long enough to develop that it wasn't like one person saw the other and said, oh, let's do that. Yeah. A lot of times it was just convergent evolution, people having the same
some ideas
stroke
are
of inspiration
inevitable
at the same time.
Inventions, they're just inevitable based on what's available.
But Apple made it to market in 1976 with the Apple One and just sold a bare circuit board for $600 and
66 cents.
What's that? You could buy that and then finish it yourself by making your own case for it or doing something. I've seen some pretty weird looking cases. The sort of famous one that you'll see around a lot is a wooden case, which is like this gigantic wooden typewriter. And someone very sort of sloppily carved the word Apple One into the, yeah, the top edge.
That's the one in the Smithsonian. That's why everybody sees that.
Okay.
But they didn't sell very many of them. I think they only sold about 200. Yeah. And so they're very rare.
Very expensive now. And they sell for
somebody offered to sell me one for $13,000 in 2008 or something. I was like, I don't have $13,000.
Man, if you had bought that, you could have flipped it for 20 times that value.
10 years, they're like $1 million now.
Yeah, there was one that was refurbished that sold for like almost $500,000.
Yeah, there was one that sold for $900,000 something in Germany. Seriously? Yeah.
Like man, you could have retired on that.
Man.
Really blew it.
But I didn't have $13,000.
I mean,
man, just a journalist.
I think there's always those the ones that got away story. Like mine is that when Apple's stock bottomed out in 1997, I really wanted to buy. Like I went to my parents and was like, "Can you lend me some money?"
I did the same thing.
This company is not going to die.
Well, I sold a Mint Fortress Maximus when I was in middle school. So
similar,
You know,
if I had spent $10,000 on that Apple stock, it would be worth about $2 million now.
Yeah,
$10,000 to $2 million. Oh well,
that'd be nice.
But my parents very sensibly said, "We don't have that kind of money to just sitting around, and also you don't know anything about stocks. What's wrong with you?"
Yeah.
so it never happened. But what could have been?
Yeah, it could have been.
It could be bankrolling.
Yeah, I remember it being $14 a share. That's when I wanted to buy it. But I was like, 14.
I think it was down to like single digits. And that's when I was.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was so like $7 or $8.
Yeah, there you go.
That was when the Wired magazine came out. The Apple and the barbed wire. It was dark times for a while, but they rebounded.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's products like the Apple II that give people like me weird faith in this company that always seems to come up with a new good idea every decade or so. They're due for one pretty soon, I think. The Apple II was really their first great idea. And we should talk about that.
Yeah, we still haven't talked about this. Like an hour in now.
We're like 20
minutes
in.
This is actually about the Apple One. Just kidding.
The Apple One podcast.
All right, here we go.
This is how Retronauts usually goes, actually. it's a lot of rambling digression. Well,
wasn't Mystery House from Sierra coded on the Apple One? One of the first graphic adventure games, and then it was ported to the Apple II by Roberta Williams. I don't remember. This is just something coming from the corner of my brain. I don't know if it's true or not.
Well, so the thing about the Apple II is that porting from Apple I was very easy because they were pretty much the same computer.
Similar.
They had some differences, but they ran the same processor. They had a different amount of like memory and RAM and everything, but functionally they were pretty much the same thing, just the Apple II had more additions to it and also came in a case, which was nice. It came with a keyboard and it came with not a mouse, but controllers and a tape cassette drive, which eventually became a diskette drive. And it was basically a consumer ready system, whereas the Apple I was for enthusiasts who didn't mind building their own wooden case and carving the word Apple into the top. The Apple II was a consumer appliance. It came in a nice beige case with rounded edges. It looked very, very attractive, very, very compact. It just hit all the right notes, I think, for the time to sort of present a different idea for what a computer should be.
Yeah, the Apple One was the no capital version of Apple II when they didn't have money to invest in making a case, so they had to do what they had to do, you know. But yeah, the case, that plastic case, is probably a big reason why they could sell it for the price they did, because it was mass produced. I don't know if it was an injection molded, what it was made out of, but yeah, it was plastic, and you know, you can just mold it. Mm-hmm. You know, metal, sheet metal is expensive. It's heavy. You have to screw it together. More labor intensive. That increases the cost. And so that was I think it was the first plastic computer case from ever made.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting looking at the design of this, how like the whole philosophy was kind of to do more with less, to get something that could be a plug-and-play system that was affordable, but could do all these things by basically stripping it down to the minimum. So like you're saying how Woz was tasked with, you know, getting this breakout board down to the fewest chips, and he kept doing the same thing with this, saying, you know, how little can we put into this and then make it up in software to let it do all these things. So, you know, I was reading the sound, you know, it had all this expansion capability, but the actual sound chip that was in it, the hardware version of that made a click.
Yeah.
And that was the only thing it did. It made a click. And then you use software to, like, Yeah, so if anyone had one of those old Casio keyboards where you could record things and then loop it and play it back, you may have noticed if you like make a really short click on the pickup and it's short enough and then you can loop it fast enough, you get notes out of it. So you can do all these things with software without putting expensive chips in, and that sort of informed the whole process here.
At the same time, the Apple II did have some capabilities that really set it apart from other computers. It could output video in color, which was apparently because Woz wanted to play a good game of Breakout. So he created a system that could produce color.
That's what Woz told me in that interview. In 2007, I interviewed Woz for Game Developer Magazine. And I was interested in his gaming background. And he said that the Apple II was basically like his personal console. So he could design a software version of Breakout because the hardware version of Breakout was just done in discrete logic chips, and it wasn't programmed like we do today. So he wanted to program it, which is interesting because that's one of the first adventures in software-based video games, which is at that time there weren't very many of those. They only started coming out in the mid to late 70s. So he wanted to have color, he wanted to have sound, he wanted to have paddle inputs. So he had input for two paddles, and that could be combined into a joystick, an X and Y axis put together, analog. And the buttons, I think, like everything was, like you were saying, there were so many circuit shortcuts. The buttons are like the command keys or whatever, the control keys or something like that.
And the paddles were done with a tiny amount of hardware. Like all it was for a single paddle was it just like controlled the speed of an oscillator with a tiny amount of hardware. And then he used a software timer to like see how fast it was going and get a readout of the paddle.
Just all kinds of tricks. In fact, his trick of doing color with the fewest number of chips possible was one of the crowning achievements of the Apple II, because like nobody could figure out how to do color video with so few chips at the time. Just lots of tricks and hacks going on there.
That's where he basically, when you store video images in Apple II, like they're not contiguous in memory. They're placed in different places because of the way that he did the refresh timing on the screen.
That's weird.
It's very complicated. Like the color,
there was this relationship between the color and the position of the pixels, or even the subposition of the pixels.
So it's a very
strange hacky solution, but it worked.
So
lots of crazy stuff happening underneath the hood, but. You know, I guess everyone kind of learned to think like Woz because it became such a popular platform. So everyone had to, you know, program for Apple II. So it probably made people like smarter about how they approach technology, or, you know, the people who really care. Maybe people who didn't really care got stuck into the rut of just creating for Apple II. And so they went to other systems that conform to what we think of computers nowadays. And we're like, what? But who knows? Anyway, one of the interesting things about the Apple II to me is that its main chip, the CPU, was a MOS 6502, which you may recognize as the chip that powers the Nintendo Entertainment System. Mm-hmm. And because of the Apple II's popularity, that became kind of a de facto standard for a lot of American-made computers. I know... crap, I totally blanked out, but I think
Commodore 64, C64 had a derivative. Yeah. I think it has a 6510, is what they call it.
And before that, I think like the
Atari 2600 has a 6507, which is a stripped down version of the 6502 or something like that.
Yeah, but that became kind of like the standard for
The Commodore American. PET had a 6502.
That's what it was, the PET, yeah.
And well, let's see, what did the I should know the TRS-80 may have been a 6502.
Could be, but in the UK and in Japan, Z80 processors were more common, which was, you know, that kind of gets into the Nintendo origin story where, and Satoru Iwata, because he was a big fan of the Commodore PET, which was not a popular system in Japan. He was one of the few Japanese programmers that knew 6502 language, so when Nintendo needed help putting together its early games, they could reach out to Satoru Iwata, or actually he reached out to them and was like, hey, yo, I know this chip. I've programmed stuff on.
Yeah, didn't he do VIC-20 games for Commodore?
It was PET,
by
I
contract?
I think it was PET games. Oh, he might have done VIC-20.
I read that he did VIC-20, like Hal did some of. They did the Jupiter Lander, a lot of the first contract work games for the VIC-20, which is really neat.
So it's all kind of tied together.
Yeah, everything's connected.
Tiny universe. So it wasn't as fast as an NES. It was 1.023 megahertz, whereas the NES is like 3.5. But, you know, it's...
The reason kind of, they chose the 6502 was because it was really cheap.
And that seems to be the reason for a lot of people using the 6502.
You know, the quality control is bad and the yield was bad in production. And there's a story of when Chuck Peddle, the designer of the 6502, took him to a conference or something, and he had this big bucket or barrel full of them. And it turned out that only the ones on the top, the chips on the top, worked. The rest were like duds, rejects from the factory.
Well, fortunately, I've never heard about like Apple II recalls, so I assume those were all weeded out at the factory.
Yeah, they probably ironed out later.
Yeah,
within a year or so.
So anyway, that's pretty much the basics for the Apple II. Like we said, it could output to television monitors. It could do NTSC or PAL. So it could work in either the U.S. or Europe, which was extremely helpful, I'm sure, for Apple expanding its reach beyond American shores. And it shipped with its own built-in BASIC, Integer BASIC, which was developed by Steve Wozniak. That was later replaced by AppleSoft BASIC, which was, I guess, more flexible.
Yeah, that was developed by Microsoft. And so Integer BASIC could only do integers, math. So it couldn't do floating point decimals and things. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was a significant drawback.
Right.
I mean, once they...
Yes.
For bigger applications like financial things.
But you got to walk before you can run.
Yeah. And there's also the fact that it didn't do lowercase characters.
Right. In the first.
But that was good enough for a homebrew computer in 1977, which is what Woz wanted. Yeah. You know,
and that was even standard on a lot of mainframes back then. You know, you had your basic... Yeah. ASCII that was not even the full set.
You still came across, you know, console games in the 90s that were all uppercase.
Oh, sure.
Someone just released a ROM patch for Working Designs games, Lunar and Lunar 2, that allow you to play the game with lowercase letters, which was not present. It's a lot of reading to do in all caps.
Yeah,
it sounds like everybody's shouting.
Basically, yeah.
Come to my temple.
Exactly.
Save the game.
On NES, it was one thing, but when you got to, you know, like novel-length video games, It's a little fatiguing. So, I mean, there were definitely limitations to the Apple II, but those are understandable. And many of those were ironed out over subsequent releases. There were several different models of the Apple II, the 2 Plus, the 2E, the 2C, the 2C Plus, and the 2GS. Each of those had its own different selling point. Do you guys have experience with those?
I think I have all of them.
Oh, okay. So which is your favorite?
I don't know. Recently, I've been playing with the 2C Plus, which is really neat because it was the last one they produced, the last new model they produced. It has a 3.5-inch 800K floppy drive built into it. So it's just like the 2C. It's all in one except no monitor or anything. But it's got that 800K drive.
And the newfangled
one. It can run it. I think it's 4 megahertz. It has like sort of a zip chip built in accelerator, so you can switch it really fast.
So what year was that? Was that like the 90s?
Oh man, I should know this by heart, but it was, Apple IIe was discontinued in 93. It was, you know, 90 something, 91, 90, 88, 89.
Well, to me, the most interesting is the Apple IIGS, which is... Yeah. Which is the one 16-bit model that they produced.
Yeah,
that's amazing. And it's crazy that there was a 16-bit Apple II, but the really interesting thing is that it also used it kind of did the same upgrade path as the NES to Super NES. The chip that it used was the same chip that you found in the Super NES.
Yeah.
So, of course, it could be backward compatible, and that just kind of fuels the idea that Nintendo designed the Super NES originally to be compatible with the NES, even though they didn't actually execute on that. So,
The 2GS is a hybrid platform. It's kind of its own thing. It could run the 8-bit software, but it had 16-bit processor with greater colors and an awesome software synthesizer for sound, or wavetable thing, didn't it? Something like that.
And so I think the model I have the most experience with is the Apple IIe. So that was the revision where they condensed a lot of the hardware onto a single ASIC chip and brought the price down again, which I think helped it get into a lot of grade school computer labs, which is where I found it. So I'm pretty sure my grade school had Apple a lab with a dozen Apple IIe's with the usuals, Oregon Trail and all that stuff and some other games on it. And so that was where I had a lot of my experience with this platform.
Yeah, for me, Apple II is a really huge gap in my personal experience because I was, you know, growing up and in computer labs and stuff around the same time that the Apple II was sort of at its peak. But because I lived in Lubbock, Texas, where Texas Instruments had a factory, all the schools had TI-99/4As. And so I didn't really see Apple IIs. You know, every lab had a TI computer. And there was one Apple II, I don't know which model, maybe the 2E, when I was in like sixth grade. And that was like the teacher's computer in the computer lab. And they eventually phased out the TIs in favor of Macintoshes. Mm-hmm. So we just kind of leapfrogged over the two. But I did, you know, I was always super enthusiastic about messing around with computers as a kid. So I kind of ingratiated myself as the computer lab teacher's pet. So I would like go and hang out and stuff at the student computer lab. And she would let me play Lode Runner on the two.
We're not listening.
Sorry, we were looking up the timeline.
Oh, okay. I had a feeling.
1988 for the 2C+.
For the 2C+.
1988. Yeah, that was, and the, came to mind.
Yeah, and the 2E was out in 83.
If so. I hadn't drank so much gin, I would remember.
All right.
Whoops. That's the problem with Gintendo.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
this is gin apple.
So anyway, that's pretty much the basics of the Apple II. We'll talk about the Apple II vis-a-vis video games. But first, let's take a quick refresher break. We've sort of gone through the rigorous introduction to the Apple II. Let's talk about the important thing, which is the games. There were so many games, so many groundbreaking, influential, genre-defining games. I mean, it's kind of amazing. I guess, you know, the system hung on for 16 years, and even up toward the very end, you had revolutionary video games being made for it. Jordan Mechner created Prince of Persia for Apple II in 1989. Like, that's nuts. That was amazing. 12 years after the system's debut.
Yeah.
And Ultima 5 still was on there. I think it may have been the original platform for that.
Really?
Ultima 4 and 5.
Yeah, so it hung on. And because of its popularity, I mean, it was really the first breakout computer system. And it would be another 5 years before the Commodore 64 launched. So it kind of had a, you know, like a big run for a while in the U.S. So because of that, you know, the video game market was just beginning to blossom. That worked out to mean a lot of games showed up on Apple II. So if you look back in the 70s, obviously there weren't that many games that came out. There was Steve Wozniak's Brickout, which was Breakout, but with bricks.
Mm-hmm. And sideways.
What's that?
And sideways.
Sideways. That's the important thing. That was actually, I would say that was unusually thoughtful of him to create a clone that wasn't a total direct ripoff of the game he was imitating. I mean, back in that day, you had, you know, Pong clones that were just Pong, but he at least turned Atari's Breakout sideways.
Yeah, 90 degrees or something.
Totally different. But really, to me, the two big games released in the 70s for Apple II were Akalabeth and Temple of Apshai, both of which are very early, very sort of prototypical role-playing games. But the Apple II would really become sort of like the petri dish for computer RPGs for in a lot of cases. So you kind of get a sense of what's going to happen on the system with these very early releases. There were only maybe like a dozen games released before 1980 for the system. So you know, you have two big RPGs, I think, kind of shows the intentions, and I think it also shows the advantage of a computer over a console. Like, you compare Temple of Apshai to Adventure on Atari 2600, and there's a lot more happening in Temple of Apshai.
Even a lot if it more is, RAM.
Yeah. It makes a big difference.
Yeah.
More storage space, more memory, more interface options. You could type as opposed to move things around with a single stick and a button.
Mm-hmm.
So that made a huge difference.
Can you imagine as a kid in the 70s, if you're like a technically inclined kid, getting this computer where you could program anything you want on it with no restrictions? It's like giving everybody a game development kit.
Yeah, I mean, that was that's pretty much how Richard Garriott got us started.
Yeah, and so many other developers, like Tim Sweeney, and who was the other one I mentioned earlier?
It is in here somewhere.
Mechner?
Yeah,
John Romero.
Jordan Mechner.
Romero.
John Romero, yeah. He got his start on Apple II.
Yeah, so definitely an important jumping off point for many developers. Do you guys want to talk about Akalabeth or Temple of Apshai at all? I haven't really played them, but I'm familiar with them.
I've played Akalabeth in a simulator on a PC. I don't think I played the Apple II. I mean, yeah, the Apple II version. It was very primitive. It had ugly skeletons in it, but I mean, it was cool at the time.
Yeah, unfortunately, I missed out on a lot of the role-playing side of the games that were going on back then, because, as I said, I had access to this in a school computer lab. So even when we could get away with playing games that weren't edutainment, it was still going to be in short bursts, so it would be more towards the action game side of things. I didn't have it in my house. I had a different early computer, which we'll probably talk about on a different episode. But yeah, so I didn't really get to dip my toe into the Apple II, the longer games, the RPGs and that stuff so much.
It wasn't Akalabeth first person the whole time.
Yeah, like
so that
wireframe first
person dungeon crawl kind of thing. It predates Wizardry, doesn't it?
It does, yeah.
So probably. Yeah.
Wizardry was 1981, Akalabeth was 1979.
Yeah, so that's real early. And Temple of Apshai was one of the first dungeon crawler kind of top down things that of the vein that inspired Rogue and those.
Yeah, I mean, it really does look like a prototype for Rogue. It doesn't have any of the depth or substance, but there's still a lot going on. Like, it's a top-down graphical sort of adventure where you walk around and bump into bad guys and kill them.
Yeah.
Very, very simplistic, but, you know, at the time, I'm sure it was incredibly intoxicating. I love going back and watching, you know, modern-day movies and TV series where they're set in, like, the late 70s, early 80s, and people are playing these computer games and video games and being like, wow, I can't believe I can do this. Stuff like Halt and Catch Fire, or I don't know, there's some other shows kind of like that where, you know, kids play old video games and there's just the sense of wonder. And I can remember that, even though I didn't really.
E.T. is like that. Doesn't E.T. have a good video game scene or something?
I think so.
You may just hear it. But,
you mean E.T. the video game,
E.T.
right?
The movie.
we did have something very similar to Roguelike, and I don't remember the name of it, so I don't know if it was related to Temple of Apshai, but on the Osborne PC that my dad had. You know, which had this little tiny text-only screen, so you know you're limited to a dozen columns and rows of text. But so it's very similar to what you see in Rogue, where it was all just little representations. But it was another game in that genre that was very, very early.
Yeah. On the TI, there's Tunnels of Doom. Did you ever play that?
I didn't, but I had a friend who had a TI and played it and let me watch, which was about as good as I got back then.
Okay.
But it looked really cool.
Oh, on the calculator.
On the
TI-99.
On the 99, okay. Yeah. On the 99, yeah.
It was a cartridge game, but it loaded off discs like extra dungeons or something like that.
Mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah, it was pretty rad.
But that's the TI. We're talking about Apple II.
Right.
Yeah. Coming back.
Yep.
So then in 1980, you have two other very seminal games. Mystery House, which was... That was the debut game by Online, or Sierra Online.
Sierra, yeah.
Ken and Roberta Williams.
Yeah, so it wasn't on the Apple One then, like I mentioned.
Well, they might have developed it on the Apple One.
Maybe.
I moved it.
My memory's probably just flawed, but it was the first.
Do you think there were actually commercial releases for Apple One, given that it was owned by 200 people?
I don't think it was a commercial release. I think it may have just been developed for fun.
Shared around, but
yeah,
that could be.
I just disregard that.
It's fine because I mean, it does kind of get into something we haven't really talked about, which is the communities that grew up around these. You know. There were the, you know, user groups and things like that.
Yeah, and publishing a game in Richard Garriott's time was a Ziploc bag.
Yep, a Kala bag. It was not exactly...
baggy.
Yeah, it was not exactly like, you know, a deluxe edition game you get now with like a porcelain statue and a steel book. It was pretty much the opposite.
Off a disc, yeah. And it certainly makes sense that some of those 200 people who had the Apple One kit would, and were messing with it would have been the people to go on and... be developers for the Apple II once it actually happened.
And probably most of those systems were sold in around, you know, Silicon Valley. Like, I doubt that, that computer had national distribution. So probably this little pocket of people who started using this computer, and then the Apple II came out nationwide. They sort of had the leg up on it. So
House was the first graphical adventure game, I'm pretty sure.
Yep. It was like it was a hybrid, really, of text and graphics, but it did have it was kind of like a Colobeth style wireframe graphics for each scene.
Yeah, hand drawn, really, really bad graphics, but they're neat. That was a new concept. It was a text adventure game with pictures, essentially. Mm-hmm. So,
and at the same time, 1980, also you saw the sort of pioneering graphical or text adventure game come out to Apple II, Zork, and that had been around since 1977, 78, it kind of evolved over the course of a few years as a mainframe system collaborative effort at MIT.
Yeah, and heavily influenced by the Colossal Cave Adventure that we were talking about, which was really the origin of that whole genre.
And that had been a non-commercial release, but 1980 saw the first public commercial release on Apple II. And, you know, we talked about how Apple II gave developers the ability to create more and do more than consoles. But in this case, they actually had to cut Zork into two halves, Zork 1 and Zork 2.
I think it's 3.
I think Zork is pretty much just 1 and 2, and then 3 is sort of like its own new thing. But it was basically two games, and... or it was one game, but they cut it into
kind of like... Yeah, too big for a PC, essentially.
Yeah, because those added memory before it were all developed on mainframes where...
Yeah, it's called Dungeon.
There were a lot
originally.
Of limits, but they certainly had a lot of memory available.
Yep. So so that was kind of the beginning of Infocom as a company, and they would be a major presence on Apple II pretty much through their end. They were eventually bought up, as we talked about last episode, actually, or two episodes ago, the Activision episode. They were bought up by Activision, which then became Mediagenic, and it all fell apart. But
they also
stepped
stone into being big on Macintosh, too. So.
Yeah, but during the sort of golden era of the Apple II, Infocom reigned supreme for text adventures. In 1981, you see more diversity in games. You have other text and graphical adventures like the follow-up to Mystery House, not like sequel or anything, but just the next Sierra Online game, which was Soft Porn Adventures, which I don't know anyone who's ever actually played that.
I've played it.
Have you?
Yeah. We had it for the Atari 800 when we were kids, of course. I think it was a bootleg copy. It was, you know... It was kind of raunchy, but not really pornographic. It was very tame by modern standards, but it was fun for a couple of little kids to play.
Just a little farther than Leisure Suit Larry.
Yeah, Leisure Suit Larry was based on Soft Porn Adventure. Yeah. The story was very similar, but it had graphics. So,
yeah, I've never played it, but I looked at a... I watched, believe it or not, there's a long play of it on YouTube. Because what could be more exciting than a long play of a text adventure?
He said long play.
That's right, Beavis.
It's an old reference.
I know there's videos of someone playing it through, but you kind of lose something with a graphical adventure when you know all the choices to make and you just like type that out. But it didn't really seem to have a lot of, you know,
sex. It was more just like you were traveling through descriptions of really, really overwritten descriptions of seedy places with roaches and dirty bathrooms and stuff. I was like,
eh. Yeah, that's a good description of it. It's mostly just that atmosphere you're in. It's not really a sex game.
Right.
Did it ever make it to the hot tub with Roberta Williams on it from the
cover? It did not. But that's definitely why that game is best known, because you have like people who worked at Sierra Online, including Roberta Williams, naked in a hot tub. Three women with a waiter holding a champagne. Yeah. Was that Ken Williams, actually? Was the waiter Ken
Maybe,
Williams?
Maybe, but I'm sure he was excited about that.
It's like, yes, I will volunteer for this photo shoot. On the more, I don't know, the less smutty, more punch-a-Nazi side of things, you had Castle Wolfenstein, which a series that still lives on. There's probably going to be another Wolfenstein game out this year or next year. Is my guess. It's very different these days, but Castle Wolfenstein was very influential. It kind of had the top-down view of Temple of Apsai, or you know, if you wanted to look at the arcade inspiration, something like Berserk or Frenzy. But it played. It did not have just like the pure shooting action of an arcade game. It was more.
Yeah, you took steps. It was like one step at a time, and then you have to find a gun, find some bullets, hide from the guards and stuff.
Yeah, there was stealth to it. Yeah. You could put on disguises. You could dress yourself as an SS guard.
Wow. My brother played that on the Atari a lot. So he had ports of these games. Yeah. Same with Temple of Apsai. Played on there.
The one step at a time also makes it sound like sort of a filtering in the roguelike influence there.
Maybe. I think Rogue came out in 1981. So, I think it's a lot of these ideas just sort of came together at the same time.
Yeah.
Didn't it have voices too?
It did. It had like very, very simple digitized voices saying "Octoon."
Yeah,
which you know, when you consider the fact that the speaker was basically a clicker on or off, the fact that they could fake someone speaking German even in a very staticky way, it's
code modulation.
Isn't it?
It's kind of impressive.
Yeah, it's neat.
And then the other two big games. Well, Adventure showed up on Apple II that year. Ben, you want to talk about that one? I see you made notes.
Oh, yeah. So I was just confirming that was a port of the old original Advent Colossal Cave Adventure codebase, which had been embellished on many times since it was originally done in the PDP, on a PDP 11. So, you know, originally it was this guy, what was the first author's name? Will Crowther. He was a caver, and he was just wanted to convey the experience of exploring through a bunch of caves, and so he kind of made that into this text adventure prototype, and then some other people came on and added fantasy elements, and it kept evolving, and a part of it eventually made it onto the Apple II.
So that's kind of like almost, you know, the origins of video game role playing in a sense. But in 1981 you had two games that really defined what role playing would be, which were Ultima 1, basically the next game from the creator of Akala Beth, Richard Garriott. And it really did lay down a lot of the basics of what RPGs would be. And Wizardry, which was sort of the definitive dungeon crawler. And there are still games being made in the Wizardry mold, such as my personal favorite, Etrian Odyssey.
Yes.
And, you know, almost 40 years later, like that's still a very viable style of game. Like
Japan loved them some Wizardry.
They did.
And so it influenced so much.
Yeah, I think that came to them through, some of the people who, Japanese developers who were into RPGs in the early days, played Wizardry in English. But then Hank Rogers, the guy who would eventually go on to bring Tetris to Nintendo, developed a game called The Black Onyx for Japanese PCs. And that was the first game developed specifically for the Japanese market, the first RPG, and proper RPG, I think, you know. And that really did
what
become.
What platform
sort of
was that?
That was, I want to say, PC 8801. It could have been NEC. Could have been FM1. I don't know, but it was you know, one of those early Japanese PCs, and it became hugely influential. And, you know, even though Japanese RPGs eventually went off more in the Dragon Quest direction, that love of dungeon crawlers never really died. So, yeah, that Wizardry has become more of a big deal in Japan than in the U.S. And that actually, I think, had an impact on the career trajectory of one of the founders of Cirtec, the company that made Wizardry, Robert Woodhead, would eventually leave the company in the late 80s because he just, like, Japan loved his game, and he would go to Japan, and he loved Japan. So he founded a company called Animego was into bringing anime to America.
He's one of our hometown guys. Animego is down here in Raleigh.
Oh, it's in Raleigh? I thought it was in Wilmington.
Wilmington. That's right, Wilmington.
But close, yeah.
Wilmington, but
He's definitely someone I need to track down.
He's a great guy. I've run into him at conventions a few times. He's really easy to talk to.
But yeah, it's just kind of interesting how there's all these intersections. Like, the video games industry in the 80s was very, very small. So you get lots of weird little collisions like this. But yeah, those were, like, Wizardry and Ultima are basically, like, that's role-playing games right there. Just about anything you want to find in an RPG is either in one of those two games or Dragon Quest. It's hard. Or Rogue, I guess.
And the precursors of Rogue. I mean, that's such a complicated lineage that goes back through mainframes. There's a lot of contested who did what first. Mm-hmm. There was some games like that on the Plato educational system and in the early 70s. And it's complicated. But yeah, Wizardry, just profoundly influential.
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of these cases, people, you know, took ideas that they had seen before elsewhere. But kind of the important thing that they did was to bring those all together into a package that they could, not only that they could sell, but...
Parties? Did Wizardry have parties?
It did,
That may have been one of the key innovations versus those other games. A party-based RPG.
That's true. I think Ultima 1 was just the avatar.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Party.
Yeah, a lot of the first iterations were single-player character. Yeah,
single person.
I mean, even Dragon Quest did that. Yeah. The first game was a single-player game, or a single-character game, and then the second game introduced, you know, a party. So... Wizardry definitely, like, super influential. I'd love to do a full episode on that series sometime, but definitely one of the reasons the Apple II was so important, I think, because it really was, again, you know, a lot of these ideas did exist and were kicking around before that, but this is where they really took form, and someone put them into a package and was like, this is a self-contained product that you can enjoy. And actually, Wizardry was more than self-contained because each of its next few sequels sort of required you to have played and completed the previous game. You could take your party into the sequel.
Yeah, transfer them over.
Yeah. And,
like Bard's Tale. You could do that in Bard's Tale. That was a good game.
Yeah, and that was kind of like, you know, the sequels became increasingly arcane. Up to the fourth sequel, which has a reputation for being one of the hardest video games ever. Do you guys know about that one?
I lost out after maybe. I mean, I just stopped paying attention to Wizardry around, I think I played the first two games most of the way through. Whenever Wizardry 4 came out, I was probably like 5 years old or something. What year
was it? It was actually like 1988. It was
okay,
really late.
So I was seven. But,
okay.
Yeah. Were there any ports to that to the NES or anything like that? I can't remember.
The first two Wizardries came out on NES. Maybe the third one. I don't think the third one.
Yeah.
And I think there was a Wizardry game on Super NES, but it was like Wizardry 5.
Yeah.
I don't think Wizardry 4 made it off of microcomputers because, again, it was legendarily difficult. You played as the villain, and the quest was you'd been imprisoned in a dungeon, and your journey was to get out of the dungeon. And to just be like total jerks about it, Cirtec took player parties. Players would submit their parties on diskette, and they would take like these high level player parties and turn them into roving groups of enemies that you would have to deal with. And Werdna himself, the villain, was like super weak, but you could summon enemies. And so you were basically fighting through heroes with the trash mobs that heroes destroy.
Yeah.
So a total inversion. It's like every dungeon level is full of crazy traps and just like teleporter mazes and all kinds of just like anything you could think of in a first person dungeon crawler that makes you angry is probably in Wizardry 4. So
that's why I never played it.
Yeah. It was probably just as well. But Wizardry 5 was a new team and totally reinvented the entire series and is really well regarded. So like the last, you know, four Wizardry games, 5, 6, 7, 8, all have great reputations, but I think they're kind of hard to play these days. Anyway,
this has become the Wizardry podcast.
Well, now we've done our Wizardry retrospective. I guess we don't need to do that one.
Farewell.
But around this time, you started to see a lot of arcade games being ported to Apple II, and I have never played any of those. How were those ports? Like, how did Burger Time turn out on Apple II?
I haven't played that one. Some of the other ones coming up in the next few years.
Atari Soft.
Moon Patrol was an arcade port. Moon Patrol was actually one of Irem's first hits. So Irem of R-Type and all that. Although the ports I read were handled by Atari.
Atari Soft. That was the label they sold.
But it was pretty. I mean, you know, so I hadn't actually, of course, at the time, I hadn't played the arcade version, so I didn't know what I was missing out on. And of course, it doesn't look nearly as good, but it gets the concept through pretty well, and it even pulls some of the tricks. So, like, Moon Patrol in arcade was one of the first games to use parallax scrolling with multiple planes of backgrounds going at different speeds. And so then the Apple version, they actually did their best to keep it. The only thing that remains is like a single vector line of mountains in the background that's being redrawn at a different scroll rate from the foreground. And that's all it is, but it still gets you the effect. So, you know, A for effort. They definitely tried to keep it all. And it was just a fun little game. You know, it's a scroll to the right and shoot things. You're in this moon buggy. You have to jump over pits, blow up things in front of you. Aliens come in from the top and you shoot upwards to get them. And it's just go until you die, basically, as it throws more and more stuff at you. But as a little bite-sized arcade experience, it was pretty nice.
I forgot the guy's name, but the designer of Moon Patrol would go on to design Street Fighter.
Wow.
Or not Street Fighter. That's right, Street Fighter. He designed Kung Fu, and then he left Irem to Capcom and worked on Street Fighter.
Huh. Wow.
So, cool. Again, small world, all these little connections.
Yeah.
To me, I don't know about you guys, but to me, the big game that showed up on Apple II in 1982 was Choplifter. There were a lot of ports and games that showed up simultaneously on other platforms, but Choplifter was, I don't know, it had a big impact on me at least. It's a shooter with a twist. You fly a helicopter and you have to take on enemy jets and missile emplacements on the ground. So, you know, that part of it, pretty standard fare, but the point of it is not just to blow up the enemies. I mean, you really don't even have to fight the enemies if you don't want. The real point is to land and pick up hostages who are in the crisis zone and then take them back to your base and deposit them safely. So it's kind of got a little bit of Defender in there.
Yeah.
But it's much slower paced, and you have to be a lot more careful with the hostages, because if you land on them, they'll die, and if you sit around on the ground too long, you know, jets will fly past and bomb you, and if your chopper's shot down while there are hostages aboard, then you lose the hostages.
Now that you say that, I'm remembering that frustration. I think I played that one somewhere.
Yeah. Well, that one was interesting because it started on Apple II and became a pretty big series on consoles and in the arcade. Sega developed an arcade port of it, there were several sequels, including Choplifter. I think it went up to 3 on Super NES. It had kind of a little life to it, but it started out on Apple II.
Yeah, Choplifter was really popular. I found it really frustrating. I think I played it on the Apple II, but it was popular, so it had something to it, obviously. Same with Moon Patrol. I have discs of Moon Patrol. Like, you know, you could tell how popular games were back then by how many copies of pirated discs you have. You know, so I could go through my collection. I've gotten like 5 or 6 collections of discs from different people. You could just tally them up. Yeah. Moon Patrol is always there. Choplifter is always there.
We didn't get away with that stuff in the school computer lab. had to have legit copies of a few things. But.
And 1983 would go on to be a really big year. Maybe one of the biggest for Apple II, just because of all the games, like really big influential games that showed up there. You look like you're about to say something. No?
I never talk.
Why did I get
I'm recalling the 83, you know. Much happened that year. If you say 83, it's like an explosion of memories come back.
Yeah, I mean, this was interesting because it's right around the time that the US console market collapsed. So Atari and television and ColecoVision were all dying. And people were starting to look more toward the personal computer. And the C64 had launched the previous year, 1982. But, you know, the Apple II was still big, still had kind of like the biggest mindshare. So you started seeing a lot of really great games that people started to look in the U.S. to the personal computer as where they wanted to put their games instead of the Atari 2600. So there's kind of a paradigm shift that happens here. And I think it kind of gave the Apple II, you know, helped give it some extra life.
A lot of people upgraded from the 2600 straight to a home computer, like Atari 800 or Commodore 64 or Apple II. And that was, it's sort of, that's one of the reasons why I made my blog Vintage Computing and Gaming, is to tie those things together, where some people just say, these are all video games, these are all computers, but they actually are interrelated. So that was kind of the
especially
next.
With the console market collapsed, you know, the PC market had to pick up all those traditions and keep them going.
The PC market was one of the reasons why the console market collapsed. I mean, just that availability there. And they were not that much more expensive than, you know, Commodore's offerings were not that much more expensive than new game consoles and souls, and you can do them. Anyway, that's for another time.
No, that's great. You know, some of the games, the big games that came out in 83 for Apple II were games that you think, oh, that seems more of a natural fit for a console. But, you know, despite being more fast-paced, more action, more sports, they did make their debut on PC. One-on-One Dr. J versus Larry Bird was a one-on-one basketball game that's notable. It was an early release. Was it the first release Electronic Arts?
It was
very early. It was the first game to use licensed likenesses of athletes.
Well, actually, Pele Soccer was probably the first for the Atari 2600.
Okay.
But for a computer.
Right. Well, and, you know, also for a sport that Americans cared about at the time.
Yeah.
Pele was pretty well known back then, but Americans were Pele, like, soccer.
Yeah. Yeah, Pele. Good old Pele.
So that was a pretty big deal. Pinball Construction Set. I guess that was more of a natural.
It's another EA game.
But, oh, that's right. It was designed by Bill Budge. This was back when Electronic Arts was like Electronic Artists.
Yeah.
Let us celebrate the creators who make these games.
I did a really neat interview with Trip Hawkins for the 30th anniversary of Electronic Arts. It should have been a couple of years ago, 2013 or something. But yeah, that was the idea, was to be like a publisher of games, to treat them like they were record albums, excuse me, like record albums, and give the creators their due, like artists, you know, with their name on the label and everything, the programmers.
Like Atari under their new corporate masters had not been.
Yeah, Activision was motivated by much the same. So that was, both One-on-One and Pinball Construction Set were pretty big deals. Pinball Construction Set was kind of the beginning of the construction genre. The idea of, like, you can be a programmer too. Here are some simple tools. Here are the resources you need. Please make things. In this case, you were making pinball tables. Yeah. And that would be a very influential game. Let's see. That year also saw Archon. Right. I assume it's Archon, not Archon.
Yeah, Archon.
Which was kind of like the precursor to Battle Chess. It was basically chess, but with melee combat.
Yeah, I disagree. It's not like Battle Chess, because Battle Chess is just chess with animations.
Yeah.
So it's got the same rules as chess. It's just the characters beat each other over the head when you take capture.
Enlighten me. What's different about Archon?
Well, Archon is a turn-based strategy game based on a board game-like setting where you have different pieces. And when you try to capture a piece on a square, then you go into a mode that is the melee combat, the action-oriented. So it's all real-time. Two players have to face off and shoot each other or smash each other.
Huh.
And there's skill at avoiding each other and stuff. That's one of my brother's favorite games on the Atari 800, which is actually the platform it originated on, Atari 8-bit
okay.
computer. But it was big on the Apple II as well, and Commodore 64.
And then finally, maybe the biggest game that year would have been Lode Runner by Doug Smith, published by Broderbund. And that was, you know, that's another one of these games that was kind of an evolution of other ideas. In this case, taking Universal's Space Panic, which in turn was kind of based on Heianchio Alien, which I covered on Game Boy World, and have said Heianchio Alien in out loud probably more times than any other white person in the world.
Heianchio!
But yeah, like the idea was, it was, you know, kind of a platformer, but without jumping. Mm-hmm. There was climbing and falling, and you were constantly being pursued by enemy robots or monks or whatever they call them in the manual, the version you play. But you could defend yourself by digging holes, and mm-hmm. the robots would fall into those holes, and eventually the holes would fill back in. If the robot was in a hole, as it filled in, then it would be destroyed and have to respawn. And your goal was to collect gold piles that were scattered around the maze and escape.
I don't remember the gold part. Are you talking about Lode Runner now? Yeah, or Space Panic? Lode Runner. Okay, Lode Runner. The gold is Lode Runner.
Yeah, yeah.
But do you know there was a clone of Space Panic called Apple Panic that was really popular?
I did. From Apple II. Yes, I have heard that.
And that's another game that's always pirated. Like, everybody has a copy. So must have been pretty influential.
Yeah, Space Panic, the big difference between Space Panic and Lode Runner is, one, there's the collection element of the gold in Lode Runner. Mm-hmm. And also in Space Panic, when you dig a hole... What's that?
Can't you climb in Lode
Runner? Yeah, there's overhand bars.
Yeah,
there's ladders.
And ladders.
Yeah. Ladders are in Space Panic also. Yeah, okay. But in Space Panic, when you dig a hole, the enemy will just fall through it down to the lower level. But in Lode Runner, it'll fall into the hole and get trapped.
And can't you bury them in Space Panic? Like,
yeah, you fill it back up. Like,
but in Lode Runner, you can't fill it.
You have to wait until it refills on its own. And also in Lode Runner, the robots can pick up gold if they run over it. So you can collect all the gold you see and not be able to escape the level. And so you have to figure out, like, which robot has the gold. Wow. So when you get into a hole, then it'll fall in the hole and the robot will drop it and you can pick it up.
Right.
So it's a very good and very influential game. That's another one of those that became really popular in Japan versus here.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the first Lode Runner was a strong seller on PCs. And, you know, there were some console versions of it. But in Japan, it was one of the first third-party games for Famicom. And all those early third-party games sold millions of copies, and so it spawned a pretty big series after that. There were several initial sequels for Famicom and Disk System, and, you know, then other platforms, Sega Master System or SG-1000. So it really became a big deal, and that was actually something Doug Smith talked about in an interview later in his life. About how it was really kind of weird that, like, it was a successful game here, but then over in Japan it became this...
A cultural phenomenon.
Yeah, phenomenon. Yeah. I don't want to, you know, belabor the point, but are there any other games sort of later in the system's life that you guys think are worth highlighting?
Karateka.
Yeah,
Karateka. Some Jordan Mechner's. Yeah. That one was really big in the computer lab. Mm-hmm. I guess both because, you know, it's fairly short but dense in challenges.
Yeah.
And unlike a lot of the other games where your actions are very... It feels like there's a lot of things you can do in it with different combinations of punches and kicks and different kinds of enemies come at you through the levels. And it was really, you know, it was really one of the first games that gave you a feeling of hand-to-hand combat. So it's the sort of thing that went on, obviously, with Mechner to become Prince of Persia, but it also feels like a real precursor to fighting games. So that was something people really loved to put time into getting better at.
In Karateka, he digitized his brother, too. Like, he did that in Prince of Persia, but I think he took pictures of his brother doing karate or himself or something.
Yeah, so frame by frame.
That was the first game I ever played on the Apple II, because we had an Apple IIe clone when I was a kid that my dad built himself. He was an electronics engineer. He bought a bootleg board, and bought the chips and assembled it, and got some copies of the ROMs or whatever.
Nice.
We had that, and man, it was a cool game, and I just set that up on my Apple IIc Plus a few months ago, and I have a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old, and the 4-year-old daughter was just playing it like crazy. She did great on it.
Awesome. Could she beat the?
Yeah, she got bar. Really far. I can't believe it. She got way farther than I could.
She get the birds.
Yeah, she got really far. I don't know.
But and there's a dog at the end, isn't there? That
I never got really, that far. Oh, dog, yeah. Man.
I'm pretty sure. There's a bunch of categories of mooks, and there's the birds, and then I think once you get near the end, the boss has a dog that he sends out first that's really fast.
Wow. Jeez. Yeah, I've never seen that, but it sounds terrifying.
I've only played it on Game Boy, and I was not very good at that version. Yeah.
Mm.
It's cool on Apple, too. The music is neat.
Yeah, and it really has some of the... I mean, because probably... I mean, probably in large part thanks to the sort of pseudo rotoscoping he does, it has some of the most fluid animation of anything that you see on that machine.
Yeah, that was a technical achievement, definitely.
Yeah, and I mentioned earlier that that game's follow-up, Prince of Persia, began life on Apple II also. It was really pretty much the last big game for Apple II coming out in 1989. By that point, you know, Sega Genesis was out in America, so people had moved on beyond the Apple II, but that is where Prince of Persia started, and it ended up on basically every system under the sun. But it was, you know, kind of that sign that Apple II continued to be influential and an important place for game development for so long.
What year did Ultima 4 come out?
That was 85.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 85. Yeah.
Okay. That's so another one that was...
considered a very important... influential game, which is the first RPG where you're not just trying to kill everybody, but right. You have a moral dilemma and all that. And that originated on the Apple II. Mm-hmm. So there you go.
And let's see, 86, we had another one of our personal computer lab popular ones was Spy Hunter, which I was just reading up. Apparently, it was originally supposed to be a James Bond game.
Yeah. Like
the guy who programmed it was listening to James Bond soundtracks and did this game, but they couldn't actually get the license. So,
so they got Peter Gunn theme.
Peter Gunn theme instead. Yeah. Right.
I think I remember hearing that too.
Yep. Dun, 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 dun,
dun, dun, dun, dun. Yeah, I think beyond this point, you get to games that are on Apple, but were probably developed simultaneously across the C64, yeah. Atari 800, yeah. Amiga,
and the PC. I'm
pretty sure that was.
Oh, yeah, and IBM DOS also.
IBM PC.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah, by that point, the market had really diversified, and the Apple II was kind of on the way out, but it was still getting these games, like as simultaneous releases. It was still a platform that people owned and that developers wanted to publish on.
Well, let's talk about the Oregon Trail then.
Okay.
That's 85, right?
So yeah, 85, I mean, that game has a long, long history. This was definitely not the first version of Oregon Trail, but...
but it was the most impactful, probably, for our generation.
I would say so.
Ended up in everyone's school on this version.
We did an episode entirely on MECC.
Oh, wow.
That was several years ago, so if you're listening at home, go check that one out.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, please share your experiences. I never really played out Oregon Trail much, but I know it is a precious part of many people's childhoods.
Yeah. In my elementary school, we had a computer lab for our school, and it was full of Apple IIe's, I think. And we go in there sometimes once a month or something and do logo or something like that. And when we were done with our logo lesson, we could play the Oregon Trail. So we would... team up, like we had partners, two per computer, because there weren't enough computers for everybody, and me and somebody else would try to make it all the way through, and it just seemed like such a huge epic adventure, because, you know, as a kid your mind fills in all the blanks and you just have an incredible imagination, so it was amazing.
But and there was a lot of real history in it, because it was developed by, like Jeremy said, MEC, which is the Minnesota
Educational
Computer Consortium, something like that. Yeah, and so you know, they had an actual historian working on this to put in things that you would have actually run into at that time in those places. And this was the part of the vector, I think, that got all these Apple IIs into so many school computer labs, was that there were these things that could capture kids' attention, but were also had real educational content in them for this platform. And so I think that helps.
Yeah, I get these things in. I can't remember where I read about it, but sometime last year I was reading, I think, a book that was talking about the origins of, I wonder if it's been published. Actually, it was a book that I, read before release.
You weren't supposed to mention it.
What's that?
You weren't supposed to mention it.
So I don't know. I think it's
an NDA on that one.
Is it out now? I don't know.
I don't know. There's some people have covered
I want to say it was a David Craddock book, so it's probably out.
Oh. Was it part of that series?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that was something David Craddock put together, a history of the Apple II. and video games. And the Oregon Trail actually started out as like a game produced on teletype.
Mm-hmm. And mainframe thing.
Like in the early 70s, there were like these really simple computers, and people would have to like input their text, and then it would print out, and they would look at it and be like, oh, so that was our move, and then they have to figure out the next
one. It's all text-based. Actually, Strong, the iChig at the Strong, which is up in Rochester, New York, just got a huge donation of Oregon Trail materials and mech stuff from the original author, and they have like the source code and things like that. It's really neat. But one thing, the last thing about the Oregon Trail is I thought it was neat that you could put in the names of your family. Mm-hmm. And so we put in our classmates, and somebody would die of tetanus or diphtheria or whatever. Dysentery. Yeah, that's what it is. Dysentery.
I like diphtheria, though. That's good.
Yeah, diphtheria. Vaccines.
Yeah, so anyway, we need to wind down at this point. I know you guys have to go. But I was wondering if there were any final things you want to give a shout out to before we wrap up this this Apple II episode of Retronauts.
Number Munchers was cool. That was very popular and influential at my schools.
Education, big and educational. Pac-Man at the same time. What more do you want?
And there was Word Munchers,
Professor Pac-Man,
Word Munchers, and other things. Those were that era. The whole throughout the latter half of the 80s and the early 90s was carried on by mech making games for the educational market, that lifespan there. But it was influential, obviously, because lots, thousands and thousands of kids played those games.
Yeah, so I think we've hit most of the ones that we had in my little grade school lab. And, you know, after I moved on, ended up with Labs with Max after that. So that'll have to be a different show.
Yeah, we definitely should do a Mac episode, but... Yeah, beyond this, a lot of the games you get, pretty much all the games you get, are multi-platform. Things like Leisure Suit Larry, Maniac Mansion, Pool of Radiance. Those are all games,
the later Zorks,
for the most part, that showed up on many, many platforms. So you can't really call them uniquely Apple II, but they did show up on Apple II. Like, this was a viable platform, an important place for game publishers and developers up through the end of the 80s and into the 90s. So that really speaks highly to... the nature of the system and its success. And I think also a fine testament and a good way to end this episode out is to point out the fact that even though Apple produced its final system update for the Apple II in 1993, it actually received a new version of ProDOS, ProDOS 2.4.
Mm-hmm. Late last year, right?
Yeah, it received a final system update, or maybe not final, maybe there'll be another one. But yeah, in 2016, a guy named John Brooks put together ProDOS 2.4.
Yep.
I have no idea what that adds.
Can you like have use run
Twitter
it.
Or something?
No, I've run it on my 2C Plus right when it came out. It fixes some bugs, but it also adds a neat little sort of menu launcher system where you can sort of use your cursor keys to scroll through a file system easily without typing commands. That's really neat. The Apple II has a huge following. You know, every year there's Kansas Fest, which happens in Kansas City, where a small group, I say huge, but, you know, as far as old computers go, it's very dedicated. A small group gets together every year and they do Apple II stuff. And somebody just programmed a new programming language for it, and they're still developing games for it. And it's just incredible. It lives on forever. Apple II forever. That's what they say.
Yeah, definitely. I mean... It certainly seems to be that way. And I think it's a testament to the quality of the platform that many of those old computers still work, you know, 40 years later. You said, you know, your daughter was playing Karateka, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. Compared to Macs, they work great. The Macs have bad capacitors and breaking plastic, you know, all kinds of problems.
Well, now they're made of metal.
Yeah.
By God.
Don't. And they're not going to work either in like 10 years.
Oh, well. So it goes.
I'll just buy a new one.
That's the plan. The planned obsolescence. Mm-hmm. That's how it's built these days. Anyway, so that wraps it up for the Apple II and for the debut episode of Retronauts East.
Retronauts East.
So, guys, thanks for coming in, taking time out of your afternoon.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Talking about
Apple II. It's my pleasure. That's
definitely
great.
And we'll try to do this once a month. And talk about cool things that maybe wouldn't get picked up at the normal Retronauts sessions. So for Retronauts, this is Jeremy Parrish. You can find me at Retronauts.com, because that's where I work now. I'm on Twitter as GameSpite. Retronauts, of course, is supported through Patreon, patreon.com/retronauts, and the video section, patreon.com/GameSpite. Two ways to help us make video content, or content, retro gaming content, yes. Anyway, that's enough about me, Benj.
And don't forget, patreon.com/BenjEdwards to support.
And where would we find you on Twitter? Facebook?
At BenjEdwards. I don't use Facebook. Oh. VintageComputing.com.
Very good.
Ben?
And I don't have a lot of presence right now. I'm on Twitter as Kirin, K-I-R-I-N-N. If I ever get my stuff together enough to make some games, I'll be sure to let you all know, but don't have anything really up right now. So.
All right. Thanks again, guys. And thanks, everyone, for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. Sorry if there are audio problems. The next episode will sound better, I promise. And we'll be back in one more week with a full episode, I think, hosted by Bob. So look forward to that. Thanks again.